Welcome to Green and Red, scrappy politics for scrappy people, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the silky smooth sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I am your co-host, Scott Parkin, in San Diego, California. And as always, I am joined by
Bob Bazanko, and right now in Houston, Texas. And it's a belated Scrappy Sunday, Scrappy Monday, you know, however you want to put it. So not a happy time, not a pleasant week for lots of reasons. So.
Yeah. We're going to forego our regular format of Scrappy Sundays. We're going to pass on the This Week in Radical History. We'll probably do one next week. But just wanted to focus a little bit on the many words to describe it, the tragedy that is unfolding in Gaza right now. The mass murder, ethnic cleansing, whatever you want to call it, that the Israelis are about to lay down on Palestinians in Gaza City and the Gaza Strip, and just talk about that. I would say that both of our hearts are very heavy about what's happening, and it's been 75 years this year actually since the Israel became a state and began this forced displacement and disenfranchisement and dehumanization of Palestinian people. We've talked about Israel many times. We've talked about Palestine many times on this show. It's an issue that Bob and I actually organized on when we first started working together 20-something years ago. And so as we see what's unfolded in the past week and what will probably be unfolding in the weeks to come, we thought we would just talk about this a little bit. And we're also probably going to have some more shows on this coming up, including with some guests. But I think we were going to actually start with a little bit of a background and history of some of what has led us to this moment.
Yeah, the word tragedy is just used frequently, but in the classic sense, that's what this is, because Greek drama, right? A tragedy is something coming, it's inevitable, but you can't do anything to forestall it. And that's clearly what's happening here. And actually, speaking about This Week in History, the last time we were together, which was, I think, a day before this current crisis began, we mentioned the 50th anniversary of the Yom Kippur War and pointed out how transcendent that was, and how it created conditions that are still around today and then the next day. Neither of us are experts at this. We probably know more than the average bear, but I claim no expertise in Middle Eastern history, although I do know the history of the U.S. fairly well and the history of U.S. imperialism. And whenever I talk about something, I always say, people don't just wake up one day and create some kind of cataclysmic event. I wake up on December 7th, 1941 or September 11th, 2001 and just say, hey, let's blow up Hawaii or let's hijack airplanes or whatever. And clearly that's the case here. And so I think that Scott mentioned that it's the 75th anniversary of Israel's founding this year. And I think it's important to go back even further than that. And when I teach, and I have a lecture from a class I do that's on the Green and Red page right now. It's on the YouTube page, where it's like about a 2-hour background on the U.S. and the Middle East, which is going to be more detailed than what we do today. And I start there with the Ottoman Empire. And I think as a historian, obviously, we go back and do these things. But I think it's important to understand, because there's so much going on here. And the media likes to put it in these very blunt moral terms, right? Good versus evil, these epic battles. And or the clash of civilizations, or it's, you know, Muslims versus Christians or versus Jews, or when it puts it on all these terms. But there are more fundamental issues that have been in place for a long time, and particularly I think imperialism, colonialism, and the region that today is in flame came out of the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire had established control over what we would refer to today as the Middle East and the Balkans and Europe. And then in the early 20th century began to fall apart. And right before World War I, that's actually what precipitated World War I in Europe, it really broke apart. And at that point, Europeans dashed in. And this is when you start to see their interest in the region really take root. And from that point on, the key issues in the Middle East have become, obviously, oil, right? And we're not going to talk that much about that, but oil. Arab nationalism, which becomes especially important after World War I. And in this particular case, Zionism in Israel. And Zionism was an ideology developed in Europe in the late 19th century, which argues that since there are Jews all over the world, there's this disparate group of Jews everywhere, right? Especially throughout Europe, Germany, Russia, Poland, France, everywhere, that they should have a homeland. And that homeland should be in Israel, as they refer to it. But on every map at the time, up through really 1947, would have been called Palestine. And this ideology became more powerful and prevalent in the World War I years. And the Europeans took note of it. And you started to see European countries get together to essentially say, what are we going to do about the Ottoman Empire? Right. And I'm not going to go into the details. And again, if you want to get some of that, you can jot down what we're talking about here. Or you can watch the longer video we put out. But you have the Hussein-McMahon Agreement, the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Probably the most important will be the Balfour Declaration, which Lord Balfour, the British Foreign Secretary, put out, I think it was in 1917, where he basically said, Her Majesty's government looks with great favor upon the creation of a Jewish state in Palestine and Israel. So this is the first time that you had a European statement saying that Jews deserve their own homeland, right? Jews are an ethnic group. It would be like the Kurds today, I think, would be the kind of closest parallel, right? Where you have this large ethnic group, which is landless, it's dispossessed. The Kurds are the largest ethnic group in the world that don't have any kind of particular homeland. Right? That would be what we're talking about. And from that point on, it became much more important to the West, not necessarily for any, because they, you know, favored Zionism or favored Jews, just because there's land there. It's incredibly, there's a lot of wealth there. I understand that there's oil there. And later in the 20s, you would see the Europeans come together to develop, to carve up the region for oil concessions and the so-called Red Line Agreement. And this is when they all come in. And it's like mob families. It's like the Sopranos who carve up Northern Jersey or something like that, right? But the Europeans obviously took an interest in that too. And they weren't unaware of what Zionism meant or what kind of instability it would create. At the time, Palestine, the population of Palestine was like 650,000 Arabs and a significantly smaller number of Jews. It was about an 8-20 or 90-10 allocation of population. It would remain that really up until World War II. But the Europeans get more involved and the Americans got involved in 1919 as a kind of an offshoot of Versailles. Woodrow Wilson created something called the King Crane Commission, which sent Americans to Palestine to do these surveys about what they should do in the region. And the first time I ever read about this, I read this particular observation, which I thought was really quite stark and quite, you know, prescient and powerful. But one of the Arab political representatives to whom they spoke in 1919 said, if the Jews come to our land, they do not come to coexist and share it with us, but with the intent to wipe us out and build their nation on the ruins of our own. You don't have to agree with that. You can think it's insane. You can blow it. But the point is, that's out there already. This is in the early 20th century, more than a century ago. But the King Crane Commission recommended that the Europeans essentially take over that region, and that would be what the League of Nations did, right? The mandate system where European countries were given control over particular countries in the region. So France got control of like Syria and Lebanon, Britain got control of Iraq and Palestine, right? And the idea there would be that the Europeans would shepherd them toward eventual autonomy or sovereignty, which is right. This is what imperialists do, right? You're not ready for independence. You're not ready for sovereignty. You're not mature enough for democracy. So we'll stay there until you're ready, right? And of course, as oil becomes more important in the region,
like babysitting.
It's exactly. It's a very paternal attitude. A lot of people who do postmodern studies will go into this. I tend to see it as a very traditional imperial relationship, but the Red Line Agreement, like I said, is just shortly after that too. So oil really comes in and makes it more important. But the King Crane Commission did say that it would be a mistake to create a Zionist state. But the report, of course, was ignored, and the Middle East was divided up. And then with oil, it becomes even more important. And then in the 30s, you have not early in the 30s, but you start to see the issue of Zionism becomes important, especially as the National Socialists, the Nazis, the forerunners to a lot of American Republicans today, become more powerful.
There's very fine people on both sides.
Fine people on both sides. And that now the Holocaust is, that's not going on yet. And attacks on Jews were commonplace throughout Europe. I mean, Merchant of Venice, 1598, was about anti-Semitism, right? That it's scary, but within the European context, there's nothing there that alarms the Western leaders yet about the Germans. And they're still interested in the region. In 1937, Britain created something called the Peel Commission, P-E-E-L, which advised the partition of Palestine into an Arab state, a Jewish state, and a neutralist area, which would have, I think, the main religious cities in it, which would be neutral cities, right? But obviously, World War II and the Holocaust created a much different context for that, right? The Holocaust obviously gives a great impetus to the idea of Zionism because of the horror. So it's just this horrific thing, which, what didn't Netanyahu say something recently, like in the last couple of months about the Holocaust? What did he say? I forget what he said now, but he made light of it. I don't remember, but he's insane, right? He's a sociopath too.
But I missed whatever he said.
Yeah, I forgot. It was just one of those things where you just slack jaw when you see it. But at any rate, during World War II, the horrors of the Holocaust obviously led to an intensified move toward creating this homeland. And you started to see significant numbers of Jewish settlers come in. Lefties especially love to use the term settler colonialism. And I'm not sure how many of them actually know what that means. But this is clearly a case of settler colonialism from the late 19th century onward, where you have this kind of indigenous group of people, these Arabs, and these Jewish settlers come in and pretty soon, as we'll see, have control over the land, not just the land, but the best land and the water, which is obviously really important, right? And then they'll create an apartheid state. But at the end of World War II, the British mandate was still in effect. But these Jewish settlers began to take action, right? And they created groups like the Haganah, which would become the kind of the precursor to the IDF today. And then groups like the Stern Gang and the Irgun, which at the time were called terrorist organizations, right? Unapologetically almost. And they were led by people who would later become like the prime ministers.
Menachem Begin was the head of the Irgun, right? And when we say terrorists, like when we're talking about the Stern Gang and the Irgun, we're talking about people who instigated bombings and assassinations and you know, that level of violence, which we typically do label, or which popular discourse labels as terrorists. Bob and I have different standards for terrorism.
Yeah, and their targets were actually initially not just British, but were British. What they want, part of the group, and it actually proved the terrorism works, right? Because one of the key targets was to go after the British representatives there, right? And so in Jerusalem, for instance, they attacked the King David Hotel, which was the headquarters for the British delegation there. They bombed it, killed well over 100 officials, right? And in time, the British was worth it to them, and they left. Now, at the same time this was going on, this was really important, there was a massive dispossession of the inhabitants of Palestine, the Arab inhabitants of Palestine, which is the Nakba, N-A-K-B-A, which means like cataclysm or catastrophe, which really has never ended. And in the Nakba, in just a brief period of time, the numbers are varied, but they're huge, somewhere between 600,000, 800,000, I've seen numbers as high as a million, Arabs were forced out of their homeland. It was just taken away from them, right? Again, settler colonialism, right? And they fled to places, Jordan, Lebanon, places throughout the region. And then in 1948, the United Nations invented Israel. It declared a Jewish state. And here's a trivia question for you. What was the first country?
I feel like I used to know this and now I'm forgetting. Was it South Africa?
It was Soviet Union.
Soviet Union.
Soviet Union was it, and the U.S. did. But at the time, there was actually a debate inside the U.S. Over that. Yes, obviously Truman voted to recognize it, but there were significant members of the U.S. establishment, especially in the military and in the establishment, who were didn't want to be seen as going too far in favor of Israel because of oil. They knew that oil could always be used as a political weapon, and because if there were ever a conflict, they would need access to the Red Sea and the Mediterranean and these kinds of sea lanes, right? I think George Marshall, for instance, actually argued against recognition of Israel. I'm pretty sure it was Marshall who did.
And just to go back to the Balfour Declaration for a moment, that's also where we see Lebanon go to the French and countries like Iraq go to the British. And then they begin to develop their own Arab states, which are what in 1948, who goes into conflict with Israel when it gets its statehood.
Yeah, although In some cases, it's a little more because what in a lot of these cases, the kind of ruling families actually were in league with the Europeans. And so you actually, in many of these places, had this kind of fissure between these kind of staid, old, kind of sclerotic monarchies and the people, right? And amid that, you get the Nakba, and which is catastrophic. And you also see throughout the world, you have people who support Israel sending money and weapons and things like that. So Israel, by this time, has actually a fairly significant army.
Right.
Around this time, and this is something that I discovered probably 10 years ago now, I was just looking through for fun, I'm reading old diplomatic cables just for kicks. But I came across this cable I'd never seen before, and the date was May 1st, 1950. And every time I talk about the Middle East, I bring this up. And the title, it was sent by Dean Acheson to all of the American officials in the entire Middle East, consular diplomatic officials at the Middle East. It's May 1st, 1950, ironically, May Day. But the title is striking because it says, anti-Americanism resurging in the Arab world, right? Mm. One, it establishes that there's like a significant anti-American sentiment there and is resurging, which means it's already been there, right? And what's amazing, if you read the thing in its descriptions, it could have been written last week because it talks about the bombings and the press and the media. But one line that stands out, I wish I had it here. I should have done it to get it precise. But one of the lines, it says, whether the Arabs are motivated by this or that, or lists a bunch of things, or by legitimate concerns over our position on Palestine. That's not the exact wording. That's not verbatim, but that's what it meant. So on May 1st, 1950, the U.S. understood that it had significant opposition politically within the entire region, that it was getting worse, and that much of it was based on America's support of Israel, and it understood that was not surprising. It was credible, right? So this is in May 1st, 1950. The U.S. throughout the 50s continued to support Israel, but it wasn't all in yet. And that wouldn't come really until later, which we didn't do this week in history, but last time, like I said, we talked about the Yom Kippur War and then the Six-Day War and the Yom Kippur War. And that's really when the U.S. threw it all in, right? And we can stop there because I think that background or history is really vital, and it's kind of missing in all this. You know, we're seeing, especially in the U.S. media, and it's obviously, it's as horrific as you'd imagine, but you're seeing all this kind of like unprovoked attack. It's like after 9/11, why would they do that? They must be animals, right?
Barbarians. I think barbarians.
I think the British, the Israeli defense minister called them human animals. And the idea there, the dehumanization, as you said earlier, was...
I actually think an important comparison that Netanyahu made the other day was he said that they are ISIS.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And who in American context are barbarians because of how...
And this goes to Edward Said and others who've written about Orientalism and the way we look at that part of the world. Orientalism is, you know, really one of the essential texts if you want to study the cultures and the differences in this region. And this kind of leads to that whole kind of class of civilizations idea where you dehumanize these people. And you still see that today, right? And if you, God forbid, watch, I've been spending way too much time on social media. It's horrifying, right? Where you really do have people referring to Palestinians, to people in Gaza, the most disgusting for calling them. It's like the Nazis. It really is cockroaches, human animals, this, that, accusing them of all kinds of barbarity. And
putting out just in the media, of course, right, is completely complicit in it. Like the Western media is completely complicit in it, which we can go into. The Western media has always been complicit in it. And we see things like silencing of certain voices, like which Nathan Robinson getting fired, or you were telling me earlier about the all the Arab commentators on MSNBC were furloughed or suspended or whatever. It's just, it's.
Yeah. And again, this is, it's a very minor thing in the bigger picture. I was blackballed at Pacifica in 2002 from Pacifica, the so-called radicals for defending the Palestinians, and the great radicals at Pacifica, including St. Amy Goodman, didn't lift a finger, didn't care. Right. And so I got attacked as an anti-Semitic, and that's obviously, that trope is very powerful. Right. And we're seeing that. We can't go on and on for hours, but obviously the use of anti-Semitism is really powerful, right? Because it's become essentially any critique of Israel, no matter what Israel does. It's talk about really an unfair kind of way to look at this, but you're seeing this whole time. And you have governors like the governor of New York and who are tweeting, this is anti-Semitic, and These are liberal Democrats like Kathy Hochul, who's like, you shouldn't be out having rallies in support of the Palestinians. We'll get to that. But to just finish off the history, from that point on, you started to see a far more aggressive Palestinian response. I think the PLO was organized in the early, I can't remember precisely, the 1960s. Something else that's really important here, and we'll get to this in a minute, because when we talk about Hamas, the original, not the original, but much of the original opposition or resistance in the region was left. And that's another part of this that's left out, that's ignored in the equation, because like, so much of this is about colonialism, but it's also about the kind of, after the Cold War, especially the left, right? The resistance throughout much of the Middle East in the period after World War II was a left resistance. And you had, you know, not necessarily communists or socialists, but in many ways nationalists, like Nasserism, and you had coups. And
it's the Third World Liberation movements that you see in Cuba and Vietnam, but exactly. It's also the Palestinian, Palestinian Liberation Organization.
Yeah, and you have to see it within that context, because like in the 60s, especially, when you looked at the 60s, you paired or joined these people together, right? Hossein Min, Fidel Castro, Mandela, Arafat, right? Those were all in the 70s, right? Those were all kind of iconic figures on the left, whether they were or not. In Palestine, for instance, there was actually a group, an avowedly Marxist group, George Habash and the Palestinian Front for PLP, right? But this is also part of it too. In the United States, in addition to having this, and that was part of the big approach, because the Soviet Union at the time is actually making overtures. And so the Soviet Union armed much of the Arab, many of the Arab states in 1973. When the Yom Kippur War broke out. So this is also part of that too, which is why Kissinger gets so deeply involved in it, right? Because it's this, I know we're all over the place, right? But this gets to an important, I think, issue as well. Because so everything's important to this, right? But to a lot of people, I'd say a lot of people, you know, probably on the left and liberals, but you actually, this is one of those weird things where you have this ugly right-wing group, which is some of them are, it really is anti-Semitic, right? And then you have this left critique, right? But many of the people on both sides, and they're not equivalent. There's no equivalence here whatsoever. But there is this idea that the United States supports Israel because of AIPAC and because of the power of the Israeli lobby and all that. And it's clearly very powerful, absolutely. But I happen to think that, and actually Kissinger and Nixon said this many times, the U.S. really got more deeply involved in the 70s, 60s and 70s especially, because Israel served this really vital strategic purpose for the United States in the region, which is the kind of, I think Noam called it what, the gendarme, you know, the cop on the beat, right?
Yep.
Where the United States can't really go into that region and take care of things. And these proxies, which is why it helped overthrow governments in Iraq, and it opposed Nasser, Lebanon in 1958. The U.S. is all over the place. But Israel served that incredibly vital strategic purpose there, right? It takes care of business. And Iran did too when the Shah was in power, right? So the United, and now the U.S. is trying to get Saudi, which has been doing, right? Saudi kind of does that too. So the United States always wants allies, it wants cops in the region to take care of it. Because when the U.S. tried to do it itself, like in 2003, we saw how that turned out, right? Fallujah, and right? You can't really do that, right? And so I think that attack on the Arab left, the secular left, which is important too, is really critical, because when we take it up to the creation of Hamas, I forget the precise date when Hamas was created, but Israel and the U.S. actually supported the creation of Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other groups like that. And this is ironic, right? Because we always hear about the class of civilizations of how the United States, the main enemy of the U.S. is political Islam or fundamentalist Islam or ISIS or whatever. The reality is the United States actually began making overtures and arming fundamentalist Muslim groups in the 50s. The first place they did it was in Indonesia, to try to get rid of Sukarno. So the United States posits this class of civilizations, but the reality is the United States always saw these Muslim groups. And so in the 1950s, for instance, it started funneling weapons and money to Muslim officers in Indonesia to try to get rid of Sukarno, because the real threat to them was left secularism. And in order to combat that, the most likely ally is going to be these fundamental Muslims, right? And well, we've talked about many shows that we've done on 9/11, right? Who did the United States support in Afghanistan? In
the Mujahideen, right? Osama bin Laden, right? The Gucci Hadeen, as he was called.
And so this is a case of blowback as well. And Hamas, I think, led Gaza in 2007. And I'm not going to get into like how popular it is among the Gazans, because that's become...
And also part of Hamas won elections in 2005, I believe. And part of that was the Bush administration trying to prove that they were trying to create democracy in the Middle East and had supported Hamas having elections and winning elections as well. But even though it also turns out to be like, it wasn't actually that many Gazans who voted for them.
No, it's with the demise of the PLO, which, and really, if you read like Edward Said, the Oslo Accords, he condemned Arafat for that, which kind of was a sellout, right? Because it, in a sense, rejected Palestinian control over its own sovereignty. But the United States always, throughout the entire region, it will always support any group which is like anti-left, right? If you're a fundamentalist Muslim, but you're anti-left in that particular time, it supported the Baathists in the 60s. It supported Iraq in the Iraq-Iran War. It supported the Mujahideen who became Taliban and Al-Qaeda. So, and Hamas, that's just, there are, you know, Intercept recently had a good article, but you can go back. I've been aware of articles on this topic for years where Israeli officials, intelligence officials, military officials have said, we helped create Hamas. They gave us money to funnel weapons to them. We wanted a counterpoint to the secular PLO, wanted to discredit the PLO. And in that regard, there's clearly a case of blowback, right? The current issue, the media keeps saying it's unprovoked. And all the language, the terrorist attack, it's unprovoked. It's all right. I flipped around today. Like every NFL game was praying and raising money. And Israel gets $4 or $5 billion a year from the U.S. and they need to go beggaring, like a GoFundMe, right? On professional sports Sundays, right? It's really crazy. But there's obviously expected to be a condemnation of everything Hamas did, just like after 9/11. And that's just an innuendo. It goes without saying, nobody who's decent is going to take pleasure in the murder of civilians, these atrocities that clearly are, right? The tactic is terror. That's the point, right? And terror gets people's attention, right? And I'm not going to go launch into kind of the dispossessed and the voice of the powerless and all that kind of stuff. But the point is, if you want to pick those attacks on, I think they were the 7th of last week to start it, whatever, but that's just an arbitrary choice. It's like picking December 7th or September 11th, right? Mm-hmm. If you look at data on Palestinians who have been killed and wounded just in the last, since the first Intifada, I forget what year it started, the second one was like 2002. But if you look at the data, if that's important, if you look at the data of Palestinians killed and hurt and wounded since then, it's just this staggering imbalance. If you look at, I don't know if I understand what people understand, do people know what settlements really are, how you create a settlement, right? You bring bulldozers and army units in and you literally destroy people's homes with no warning, and you take it, right? And they claim that it's supposed to be for security or public works or whatever. But the reality is, like, pretty soon you have a family living there, right? And in these homes, which were just razed, they were turned into rubble. The closest comparison in the U.S. I would make would be Native Americans, right? In the 18th and 19th century, right? Well, you simply go in and you just kill them all and you take their land. You take the gold in the Black Hills of South Dakota, or you take all that land in the Southeast and you turn it over to cotton planters or whatever, right? And you kill them. You just kill them and you...
King Philip's War, where the goal was to just push, either kill or push all Native Americans out of what became New England.
Yeah. The Pequot. It's what happens to Aboriginal people. And this is what settler colonialism is. It's a valid term. It's a real concept. I just see people who, I think a lot of them, they hear the word and think, oh, that's cool. And they just apply it to everything. You've got to be careful. It doesn't. But in this particular case, and I think with Native Americans, it clearly does as well, it's an apartheid situation, right? Where Arabs don't have basic human rights, like civil rights, basically don't have human rights, right? They're often without water. They're often without electricity. During the COVID shutdowns, they weren't vaccinated, right? They didn't have access to vaccines. The Jewish population did.
The Israelis won't let cancer patients leave Gaza to go get cancer treatments.
Yeah.
And then Netanyahu last week says, my advice to people in Gaza is to get out now. He won't let them leave for cancer treatments. How are they supposed to get out when they're preparing their huge bombardment of hellfire on them.
Yeah, today I did a little sleuthing. Gaza's 140 square miles. Entire Gaza is on the western edge of Palestine, of Israel, right next to the Sinai along the Mediterranean.
And it used to be part of Egypt until the Six-Day War.
And it's right there, right? It's connected to Egypt, so it's border to the end, and then it's the Mediterranean. So it's access to water, which makes it very important, right? But Gaza is about 140 square miles, and I just very quickly looked up, and it's about that, which is about the size of Lubbock, Texas, Mobile, Alabama,
Detroit, Omaha,
or Detroit, or Chattanooga, Tennessee. Those are the ones I looked up. The population of Gaza is 2.2 million, right? And in 140 square miles. Now, comparatively, those cities I listed, right? Lubbock has 260,000, Mobile has 184,000, Omaha has 487,000, and Chattanooga has 182,000. So the United States Israel, with U.S. weapons and U.S. support and diplomatic cover at the United Nations, is just pummeling.
And propaganda from the world media apparatus.
From the world media is pummeling this area the size of Lubbock, Texas, which has 7 times the population of Lubbock, right? Now it has 10 times the population of many other American cities, roughly, who have the same geographic size, right? And there's no water, there's no electricity, which means that the hospitals, people in the hospitals are dying.
Plus they're bombing the hospitals.
They're violating international law. It's a war crime. The entire operation is a war crime. And essentially the argument here as well, Gazans support Hamas, so they're all fair game, right? Essentially, the U.S. has turned all of them into combatants, right? And Israel's always been an ally. Israel supported the apartheid government of South Africa. In the 1980s, Israel was really useful to like Guatemala and El Salvador. I believe, didn't Clinton and Rodrigo bring it up with regard to Chile as well, I believe, right?
Yeah.
Israelis also always been useful in providing like technology and intelligence and surveillance on groups in these particular countries. So like in Guatemala and El Salvador, Israel helped support the death squads.
Just to bring it a little bit closer to home, Cop City being built in Atlanta is based on an Israeli model about urban policing with a militarized police force. And they're building it partially to train. They were building it partially to train IDF people. And then IDF people has been advising them on the construction of it. Also, probably wouldn't be surprised if we find out some point in the future that the IDF has been advising the Atlanta police on how to fight the cops, stop Cop City too.
Yeah. And like I said, this is not what I do. I don't study Middle Eastern history. I study U.S. history and U.S. foreign policy. And so I do know the American role there. The United States over the years has provided $150 to $180 billion that's actually been allocated. The actual aid, I'm sure, is significantly higher than that, right? The United States has provided on-the-ground operational support. It's provided intelligence. Jews in the United States have dual citizenship, so they go to Israel to vote there. Some of them are going there right now to fight in the IDF. I wonder if Jerry Seinfeld, is Jerry Seinfeld going to put on a uniform? He's a big IDF supporter.
Amy Schumer.
There's not a joke about it. It's such a freaking unfolding horror. It's horrific. You have 2.2 million people in what's described as the world's largest open air prison. It's just, I don't know if YouTube still has them up. They may have taken them all down, but just go look for video. It's incomprehensible. You have settlers there throwing garbage on the Arab population. I forget, some huge number of Arab youth were born in refugee camps. Almost all of them have spent time in a refugee camp. Almost all of them have had some experience with the Israel's military or police system, which is incredibly traumatic.
So we're saying all this about Israel, about like current events, not just history, but current events.
Yeah.
And I just want to note what the editorial board at the New York Times said today. And just the headline, I'm not even going to go into what it said, but the headline is, Israel is fighting to defend a society that values human life. And so I think that says it all. That's the paper of record for the elite and for the establishment, at least in the United States. I would actually also say in other parts of the global north. And Israel is fighting to defend a society that values human life. And you know, everything that we just talked about for the last 100 years, definitely the last 50, 55 years, it shows to be the complete opposite of that. And there have been times over the last week where I've actually was surprised at some of what the New York Times was saying about what the Israelis were doing to Gaza. But to know that the editorial board, which are the decision makers at the New York Times, that's how they feel about this. And it's just, it's beyond revolting. It's beyond, it's unfathomable.
It's Joe Biden's word. And now talk about dehumanizing, because obviously it's very clear that the New York Times doesn't believe that the Gazans are, they're human animals. Is that what, right? It's so horrific, right? And to have this kind of flurry, this disgusting propaganda, which is equating Hamas with the Gazans, and it says, well, if you don't support Hamas, leave. Well, you can't, then what are you going to do? And then it says they should be guaranteed the right of return. Return to what? Return to what? It's been reduced.
Rubble.
It's destroyed. Their freaking lands have been, their homes have been taken. It's one of the crucial moral issues of the past 75 years, century. And it's one that liberals have punted on. It's one that the left has punted on. Years ago, I was part of VSA, and there were two issues which you just couldn't talk about. One was Cuba, which wasn't that bad, but the other was Israel. Just couldn't, right? Which led me to get away. And you're seeing that still, VSA is still torn apart by it, right? They're still having major issues over Palestine.
Didn't actually they put out a statement and they've reversed themselves on it this week?
I don't know. I know that Jamal Bowman, who's a representative from New York, has been an avid supporter of Israel. He's
he came out. Biden went on 60 Minutes tonight, trying to be a little bit more nuanced, but he's not. And Bowman, I saw on Twitter that Bowman was praising him for standing up for human rights, because he's saying Israel don't kill Palestinians as bad as you usually do, or you're planning to, whatever.
You know, Bernie Sanders and the squad have put out their obligatory condemnations of Hamas. And this is what they do. And liberals get upset if you criticize Sanders, you criticize AOC on this. But we're both well aware of what it's like to be in American political society. Like I said, my encounter was trivial, but they put me through 6 months of pure hell. They were like contacting UH, calling me anti-Semitic and trying to get me fired. That's nothing. That's absolutely nothing, right? I live a privileged life in that regard, right? But the fact of the matter is, we're well aware of that, but you still, you're a congressman, you're a senator. You can do that. And Biden and Blinken are just, they're as complicit as anybody, right? They're, if I hand you a cache of weapons, knowing what you're going to do with it, then obviously there's a real complicity there.
Yeah, and there's some backlash worth noting that's going on in other parts of the world to people who are speaking out in support of the Palestinians. And it's obviously not as horrific of what's going on in Gaza and the West Bank and other places like that. But we're seeing, you know, the Germans and the French cracking down on pro-Palestinian protests. I've seen video from Philadelphia and New York where the police are also being, you know, pretty hard on pro-Palestinian protests. I'm seeing where people who are outspoken about it on social media are actually being talked to by their bosses at work. We've seen this chilling effect where they've gone after Nathan Robinson or Katie Halper got fired from a podcast or whatever. But there's like Arabs and Palestinians who live in other parts of the world who are being targeted in their places of work by their bosses because they're speaking out on this. I saw where a person got stabbed because they were Muslim because of what's happening in Israel. I saw where an Israeli journalist who was critical of what Netanyahu is about to do to Gaza had a right-wing mob descend on his house in Israel, trying to come after him and his family. It's pretty ugly.
In Chicago today, a landlord who, I'm sure the guy is not all there, but there was a Muslim family in the apartment. I guess he ran it. I don't think he owned it. And he started screaming about Muslims and went and attacked the woman and with a knife and killed her six-year-old son. With a knife. And that's what happens when you have this kind of toxic, massive flood of information. It's not at all surprising. At Harvard, about 107, about 70 student groups put out a statement in support of the Palestinians. Nobody's supporting, none of these statements are supporting Hamas, right? They're supporting the Palestinian people, right? None of them are saying, yay, I'm glad Hamas killed people. None of it. And a bunch of corporate CEOs have now asked Harvard for the names of the individuals in these groups to make sure that they don't hire them when they get out of school, when they graduate, right? And the governor of New York has said, you should not be out protesting in New York and for Palestinian rights. Like, she's a state official. Now, that's a violation of the First Amendment. I know the Constitution doesn't mean shit anymore, but when a state official says you should not be exercising your free speech, that's not like me or you saying it, right? That's a state official, the governor, right? And oh, Amy Goodman, but Amy Schumer, that tweet she put out where, you know, it was a take on the old Niemöller thing. By the time they came to me, no one was let to speak out. And she's basically saying, we white women support BLM and we support gays and lesbians, but no one supports me because I'm a Jew. And so this level of victimization, the left has been active in attacking anti-Semitism, especially in the last 10 years or so, right?
Yeah.
That's coming from Trump and his people, right? But they've equated these horrific, horrible things that Trump has said, fine people on both sides, people who come to fucking rallies with Nazi flags, the Oak Boys and the Waffen, and all these wannabe Nazis, in the US, they equate that with BDS, right?
Yeah.
Like in the state of Texas, I'm not allowed to bring anybody in and use university money to pay them if they even signed a petition and support a BDS, right? It's just stunning. And this is as bipartisan as it gets. This is nothing is as bipartisan as this one, right? And it's disgusting to see these right wingers talk about, you know, because they're not in all earnest about this, right? I don't give a shit about Palestinians, right? There's nothing as bipartisan as the slaughter of Palestinians. And like I said, I think we've gone on. I think it's important to go back and look at the way this came about because, you know, that statement I read was from 1919.
Yeah.
You couldn't say this is unprovoked or who could have seen this coming, right?
No.
How could this have ever happened, right?
No.
The reality is it's pretty much inevitable. And that's, you know, and then the propaganda, at times like this, I often go back and I reread one of the best things I've ever read, which is a Tim O'Brien story. It's in the book, the collection called The Things They Care. It's called How to Tell a True War Story. A true war story is never noble. It's never brave. It's just obscene and filthy. And that's what we're seeing here, this obscene and filthy global propaganda network. And the people of Gaza, they're trying to literally survive the next minute, the next hour. And I have friends who said that they have friends there, they have family there, and their batteries on their phones are running out. And they'll say, no, I heard from him 4 hours ago and he's still alive. I just can't even imagine that.
Yeah. And they have nowhere to go. No one will let them in.
And they're going to be without water. They're going to be without electricity.
And an invasion's coming.
An invasion's coming. Yeah. And I did see today that, again, I think even Biden understands that. And this, who knows what the hell Hamas is thinking? Right? I don't know, right? As a lefty, the idea that you would put 2.2 million people in the crosshairs without them knowing about it, I find horrifying in its own. But they don't deserve this. Right? And those like the propaganda about Hamas was killing babies and beheading babies and burning babies and all that.
And rapes. They're talking a lot about rapes too.
Right? Rapes probably did occur because that's a reward. Every conflict like this, but I don't know, actually, who knows? But the fact is, there's no evidence for any of that.
Yeah.
You can't just say, in World War I, remember they were saying, Germans were bayoneting babies. What never happened? Or what was the one you said about the
Kuwaiti incubators?
Yeah.
In 1990, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, that the Iraqis were taking the incubators and throwing the babies on the ground and just leaving them there to die. These are all pretty normal propaganda techniques that get put out to demonize and vilify people who are in conflict.
And one thing, I hate playing the numbers games. Oh, they killed this many.
And just to be clear, none of this has ever been proven. No, we don't know that Iraq, it never happened.
But apparently, there were, 1,300 people killed in the initial Hamas attack? And again, numbers, it's insane to say, oh, it's not as bad because it's... But Sabra Shatila was like 2.5 times that in 1982. Well,
two times that has already been killed since the Hamas attack in Gaza. Yeah. It's probably going to be 10 times more.
But I mean, in 1982, Israel allowed these militias into these refugee camps, and they slaughtered Sabra Shatila. They slaughtered like 3,000 people, right?
Yep.
And we're not experts on this, and we're in a lot. I think much of this is just for our own catharsis, because it's been rough. Because not only are we, this is a cause that's important to us, but we both, on a very personal level, know a lot of people who are Palestinian. We have friends, and it's just something that's really critical.
Yep.
Do what you can. If this is appalling to you, and we hope it is, just go figure out. There are groups who do this. There are groups who focus on this. There's a great group called Students for Justice in Palestine, SJP. There's actually Jewish Voices for Peace is a good group. These are actually American.
And Never Again, which is another Jewish direct action group.
Code Pink, the agent of China. It's funny, right? I did that interview I did with Jody Evans a couple months ago, because the New York Times was claiming that they were agents of China because they got $1 million. And I've been here. The other day I was watching this podcast where this idiot goes on and says, I didn't really know anything about Israel, so I never talked about it. But then the State Department sent me to Israel, where I met Israeli political and military leaders. And now I'm an expert. And you know what? Israel hasn't done anything wrong, right? Every fucking day there are Americans who are in the region on the fucking government's dime and on fucking Israel's dime. I'm going now, right? Don't stop. And the Germans just bombed Pearl Harbor, right? Like Belushi. But you fucking get money from, I don't even know if they got money from some kind of Chinese affiliated group, right? It's really horrific. And you notice, you and I aren't saying like anything about Jews. Like, this is about the fucking leadership, the Zionist leadership, the colonial leadership of this state, right?
Yeah. I'll also say this. A lot of my friends are anti-Zionist Jews who are actually out in the streets right now, out doing direct action. Several hundred people got arrested at Schumer's house in New York on Friday, blockading his home. Like hundreds of anti-Zionist Jews with Jewish Voices for Peace and Never Again. And when Never Again says Never Again, they don't mean never again to my people. They mean never again to all people. And I just want to say that for us, it's not about that. It's about what these belligerent states are doing to people who live under their territory.
Accusing somebody of that, and that's why I still get upset over accusing somebody of being like racist or sexist or anti-Semitic, is so vile. Is so vile. You and I and so many others have been educated politically by Noam Chomsky, Howard Zinn, and Arno Mayer, Gabriel Coco, and people like that. So to be called anti-Semitic because you don't want Israel killing hundreds of thousands, millions of Gazans is just horrific. It's cheap. It's tawdry. And fucking Biden and Blinken are part of that as well. They don't give a shit about Palestine or East Palestine. They don't care. Biden's gone all in. I want to give Israel money. I want to give Ukraine money. I want to have wars all over the place. Did you see the stock prices for the weapons makers over the last few
years? Yeah. Same with a year and a half ago when Russia invaded Ukraine, they spiked, right? It's like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon and all of those companies are literally making a killing.
In World War One, a left journalist, Randolph Bourne, wrote, "War is the health of the state." Right? War is the health of the state. And this is by sinking in the polls. And in this regard, it's probably going to help him because Trump is a sociopath who's praising Nasrallah and calling for Netanyahu to be impeached. And he's dying because, you know, they're putting billboards up in Israel thanking Biden.
You know, the thing about it, Bob, is that everyone's ignoring the most important issue, which is why Netanyahu needs to be impeached, which is that he did not acknowledge that the election was stolen and that he recognized Biden's win early on. And Trump hates Bibi as a result of that. That's how insane our politics are, is that one party is in like chaos in the House. They're about to, the closest thing they have to a speaker at a House is a person who covers up sexual offenses or whatever the fuck
that is.
A pedophile. And the front runner is a person who is clearly in mental decline. And then the other party are just the puppets of Wall Street and the arms manufacturers and the oil companies. I guess they're both puppets of the oil companies, but they're all doing it. We're in bad shape. Maybe it was always like this in social media. It's just opened it up for us. Who knows? But we're in rough times. Things are declining fast. Yeah.
Today, Nikki Haley and Ramaswamy, what's his name? The other guy running for the Republican presidency. The two Desi who are like fighting with each other, right? But Nikki Haley comes out as the voice of reason, right? because she's basically said that essentially we shouldn't kill people just because they're Gazans, right? That's the progressive, that's the humanitarian point of view, right? Whereas Ramaswamy, they're just saying kill them all, right?
Didn't Nikki Haley this week also say they just need to go out and kill as many as possible, though?
Oh, look at the rhetoric.
Channeling Hillary Clinton.
Yeah. It's horrific. It's just, it's so dehumanizing, right? It would be, it's funny, Americans love rescuing animals. They fucking treat animals they find in the street better. They have a better view of them than they do these humans who are just being crushed by these colonialists. It's horrific. I'm not sure this accomplished anything, but I think you and I at least got a chance to vent about it. It's so horrific. And yeah, we will have people on who actually can talk about this way better than you and I can. You could speak about it with great power. Also, one other source I would recommend, there's actually a Jewish human rights group called Bethlehem. And I would certainly take a look at that. They've been good. And Haaretz, the major newspaper, has had essentially they had an op-ed last week. It's kind of funny. The New York Times is saying that, you know, what is it? Israel stands for humanity. The response was just, at any rate, but Haaretz and Bethlehem, and obviously there's like Electronic and Afada. Just there's just good resources, and you can show a little judgment.
And for what it's worth, and this is catharsis as well, is that tens of thousands of people in the U.S. and other parts of the world were in the street. In San Francisco, where I live, 10,000 people marched in San Francisco, and for no other reason, just to not feel alone and isolated, go join those marches, go join those actions. Some great people actually were doing direct action at the offices of war profiteers in Massachusetts over the week, of companies that give money and weapons and sell weapons. Don't give money. They sell weapons to the Israelis. And get involved. This is the moment. Just every day is the moment, but this is the moment to go and get involved, particularly if you're just so heart struck by all of this.
That may be the best reason to do it, just so you don't feel so isolated. It's really hard to break through. It's always been hard to break through. And now with this current level of really media propaganda, I'm not sure I've ever seen anything quite like this. This is 911 level, right? Right after 911, you're there. They hate us because we're free and you're either with us or with the terrorists. It's at that level.
It's the media and the establishment are definitely there. I do think that there's much more of a movement response in sort of Gaza, in support of the Gaza and the Palestinians, than we saw after 9/11. Maybe because it didn't happen to the U.S. directly, but I do agree with you about the media propaganda is over the top, like unbelievable. That the line from the New York Times editorial board that Israel does this because they value human lives, it's a break from reality, in my opinion. So
also do a Google search on international recognition of Palestine. I saw a map today. The rest of the world recognizes Palestine. The U.S. doesn't. All these votes at the UN, they're like 184-2. It's like the US and Israel. The rest of the world acknowledges Palestine. Their leaders might not, but Macron and what's his name, Rishi Sunak, and I don't even know who's in charge in Germany anymore, but they may not. But clearly there's global support of the Palestinians. There always has been, right? There's one of my favorite pictures ever is Muhammad Ali and Arafat arm in arm. This has been an issue that I've been aware of for a really long time. And it's one that I think in so many ways is really a moral barometer of where we are. If you just are casual about this, or if you actually endorse it and support it with blood on your teeth, then, I'm not going to say you're worse off than I thought we are, because I think you and I think it's pretty bad.
Yep.
So get out and do something. Take care of yourselves. Be careful. Be careful.
Yep. Folks, you've been listening to the Green and Red podcast, talking about Palestine, Gaza, what's going on in the world right now. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to this on one of our many audio platforms, please and review us. It helps us with the algorithms. And if you like what you're hearing, please become a donor by going to greenandredpodcast.org and hitting that support button, or become a Patreon at patreon.com/greenandredpodcast. Bob said, everybody stay safe, but also go make trouble and misbehave and whatever you do it with other people. And we'll talk to you again soon.
I'm exhausted. Last night I couldn't sleep, but when I did, I could hear bombs in my dreams. Nightmare situation. How could they be so evil? Making mortars out of children and innocent people. We expect the bombs, not knowing where next. Huddle in the corner of my room, trying to protect my little brother as the building shakes like it's possessed. But nothing stronger than the will of the oppressed. I bomb back with my lyrics and rhymes, living the times, trying to break the Palestinian minds. What's hiding in the clouds hanging over my head? My dad risks his life outside to buy bread. The fourth war in my 12th year. At this stage I'm numb, though I haven't feel scared. There's nothing I can do in this case to stay safe. I'm brave, even though this house could be in my grave. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. I want freedom for the population. 2 million prisoners living in this location, shouting at the wall, but nothing is ever changing. That's life under an occupation. Mothers mourn, frightened with grief. White sheets cover bodies that lie on the streets. Buildings turn to ash, but my mind is made of steel. So it doesn't take much for me to heal. Won't lose the will to live or lose our minds. My auntie lost her home, so she lost her life. But she is still alive, but traumatized by the bombs that flew in and dropped that night. My sister couldn't sleep, tried to stop her cries. I said it was fireworks, I was telling her lies. Where's the compassion? This is heartless. It's like they want us all living in darkness. Cutting off water and electricity for hours. They're knocking towers, but that's not knocking the power that I have in my pen. When I'm writing, I'm unstoppable. The microphone is the only escape possible, 'cause that's the way that I can speak my mind. I wonder how does the fighter pilot sleep at night, knowing he can turn the city upside down all of a sudden. Slaughtering families with the push of a button. I want freedom for the population.